Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. We have been concerned for quite some time about what is happening to our country's, well, freedoms, our Constitution, and the degree to which it's being taken apart piece by piece by what seem to be cultural Marxists in our midst. The cumulative effect is to, well, as they're fond of saying, fundamentally transform America. To discuss what is going on, its implications, and what we best be doing about it, I'm always pleased to be able to have with us Dr. Michael Rechtenwald. He is a former Marxist professor at New York University. He is a man who knows, as a result, from the inside, what these Marxists have in mind for us and how they operate. And he is always very thoughtful about how what we're seeing around us fits into these larger plans and doctrines. And I'm very pleased to have him with us always. Dr. Rechtenwald, you have been pilloried, I think it's fair to say, by your former comrades in arms, and it's all the more reason why we really appreciate you and what you do to alert us to the danger they represent. Welcome back to Securing America, sir.
Great. Thanks for having me, friend.
Let me start by asking you about a topic that I think has not gotten the attention that it deserves just yet, and that is the extent to which some of this fundamental transformation is taking place in our Congress. The specific case in point being the select committee that has been established by Nancy Pelosi in the House of Representatives to investigate the January 6th so-called insurrection. I'd be interested in how, as you know, a former Marxist, you would look at what is being done with this committee, how it has conducted itself, how it's even been comprised, and in particular, the prosecution now of some who have, I think for perfectly good reasons, declined to provide documents that have been subpoenaed by the committee. It's not clear they have the right to subpoena them, but to subpoena those documents on grounds of executive privilege. Your thoughts about what's going on here? As it looms now, there's going to be a sort of spectacular, show trial, I guess, tomorrow night in the United States House of Representatives, where they start revealing the results of their research to date.
Okay, as the Marxists take over the state, and this was very common in the Soviet Union, what happens is you have the politicization of the justice system, of the system of justice, of the Department of Justice, and of course of all the federal police. And so this is what's happening here. We see a kind of Stalinization of the justice system and the criminal justice system in particular, such that having the wrong political views makes you a criminal and effectively casts you into a gulag of sorts. And this is, of course, what's happened to the January 6th participants in the so-called insurrection. And it's happening to everybody associated with Trump in terms of their legal associations and so on and so forth. So what we're looking at is simply politicization and the criminalization of political dissent.
And to the extent that that's what's going on, how does that fit into the larger project of a Marxist takeover of a country? How critical is it to the destruction, for example, notably of, well, most obviously, you know, the democratic process of elections, freedom of speech, the rule of law itself, for that matter.
Yeah, I mean, this has a really, this kind of a show trial and this kind of arrest really is a premonitory signal being sent out by the state to warn people of the costs of dissent. So these people like Navarro and Roger Stone before him are really just scapegoats that are being used to show the public the dangers of dissent, of being a dissident from this political establishment. And this is very typical of what Marxists do. They want to vilify any dissent and make it criminal, in effect. And that's what we see taking place.
Yeah, instilling fear. And as you say, Peter Navarro is a former senior Trump advisor in the White House who has now been shackled and imprisoned briefly for, you know, not going along with these demands from the select committee. But the fear is what is being inflicted on an awful lot of other people, not just, of course, the immediate object of it, Peter Navarro in this case. And to the extent that this becomes a centerpiece of the overall project, for want of a better term, of compelling people to comply, to dispensing with, you know, the processes whereby laws are made, for example, the very fundamental principle that there is equal justice under the law, creates a sort of, well, an environment in which that fear is not only likely to be widespread, but justified, does it not?
Oh, yeah, it's very justified, because what they're doing is any political disagreement now, anything that varies from the political party line, the official party line, is basically criminalized. And this terrifies people, of course. They may become much more reticent to express themselves. We can see now that anybody associated with Trump or Trumpism or America First is basically afraid now to enter the public square. And this becomes impossible now that any kind of dissent from this Communist Party line is effectively criminal. So this is very, very chilling. This casts a very serious chilling effect across the whole country. And that's the purpose of it.
There's another facet to this, I think, that seems to be going on simultaneously, increasingly against the backdrop of these various mass casualty shooting incidents, and that is the disarming of the population. And we're going to have to take a short break here in a moment, but Dr. Rechtenwald, how does that figure into the plan of those who seek to impose this transformation on the rest of us?
Yeah, I mean, confiscation of all weapons was one of the first things that the Soviet Union undertook under Lenin. So this doesn't even begin with Stalin. It began with Lenin. And this is a necessary way. We must disarm the population to have a total hegemony, a total monopoly over power, which is exactly what socialism amounts to. And so that... you know, and these shootings are very suspicious. I don't want to say anything more about it, but the way they're driving the public crazy with the inversions of reality that are constant in our media, I think is a part and parcel of why these things are happening. People are being driven crazy by this crazy-making ideological inversion that we're seeing, where good is bad and bad is good and man is woman and woman is man and up is down and up, down is up. All of this stuff is part and parcel of this kind of inversion of reality that's underway. And this has a lot
Michael,
to do.
We have to take a short break. Hold the thought. That's a perfect point on which to return about what is really going on here and the extent to which supranational entities are at work in this transformation as well. That and more with Dr. Rechtenwald right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Summit of the Americas, taking place in Los Angeles this week, should be a moment to address a shocking reality. As a result of decades of not-so-benign neglect of the region by the U.S. government, one Latin American nation after another has succumbed to the temptation to vote in communists or other Marxists in the name of change. Today, the most important nations in our hemisphere, including increasingly our own, are embracing and promoting the radical left agenda of the modern Communist International, doing business as the Forum of São Paulo, under the influence of China, Russia, and Iran. Two more, Brazil and Colombia, may enlist this year. Instead of focusing on climate change, social justice, and buying oil from Venezuela, Team Biden should be concentrating on preserving and expanding the freedoms the Forum of São Paulo seeks to crush. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back, and I'm delighted to say a special welcome once again to Dr. Michael Rechtenwald, one of our favorite guests. He is a man who has studied closely and experienced firsthand the culture of the woke left. In fact, he's written among his 11 books Beyond Woke as a treatment of what it entails and why we want to steer clear of it. Michael Rechtenwald was a professor at the University of New York and has, to his credit, seen the light and rejected the Marxism that he once embraced and has become a very thoughtful, very vocal, and I think very informed critic of what is happening all around us. And Michael, I wanted to turn from sort of the domestic facets of this cultural Marxist march through our institutions and efforts to take down our freedoms to their sort of international counterpart, or if you will, transnational counterpart or supranational counterpart, which was much in evidence last week at the simultaneous meetings in Davos of the World Economic Forum and of the World Health Assembly in Geneva. Give us, if you would, at sort of a 30,000-foot level, what are these outfits up to? And how does that agenda tie in with what we were just talking about on the domestic side?
Yeah, I mean, these outfits are the, as you said, they're the supranational, or I would call them globalist elements here that are aiming at effectively bringing in this form of socialism that they have in mind, replete with an economic socialism, with the kind of authoritarian measures that we can expect, the kinds of authoritarian measures that are taking place in China and are being effectively exported to us through this global consortium in the WEF and the WHO. Effectively, these are sovereignty breaching. They are rights abrogating institutions. They're attempting to reset the economy to a new normal of basically reduced consumption and reduced standards of living. And they're doing it vis-a-vis what I call a woke cartel. They are attempting to make sure that only businesses that are compliant with their woke dictates will receive capital in the stock market or from banks. And so this is kind of like a global resetting of the economic order and the social order to match the kind of system that is basically underway in China. China is the model for this.
And I wanted to ask you about that because China has a very different end state, arguably, than what the global capitalist resetters have in mind, namely a world dominated by the Chinese Communist Party, in which they're likely to feature as residents of the gulag, it seems to me, rather than, you know, in a leading role. The global capitalists clearly have in mind running things instead. They certainly are making common cause against us. I would argue so are the Islamists, who have yet another end state in mind. But how would you describe the relationship between the capitalists and the Chinese communists an operational level at the moment?
Well, I think they're kind of competing socialisms, really. The so-called capitalists, I wouldn't even call them capitalists. What they are is corporate socialists. They're attempting to create a corporate state hybrid that basically monopolizes the economy and the government, the state. They're deputizing these corporations as state apparatuses, and they're attempting to bring in what I call corporate socialism, or an actually existing socialism for the majority, and total control over the monopolization of the economy on top, and state power shared with corporations. So I think they're looking at China as a model, but they're a competitor as well. China has its own ideas, but they're borrowing from the Chinese playbook in terms of their attempts to set up the kind of technological mastery over human behavior that the Chinese have managed to establish.
Yes. And we've talked about this China model in the past, Dr. Rechtenwald, and I wanted to sort of get your current thinking on it, because one of the features, as you know, of these meetings last week in Davos and the World Health Organization was the promotion of two different vehicles for engaging in mass surveillance. One was called the Global Carbon Footprint Tracker, I think. The other was the sort of universal health ID card. And both of these are, it would seem to me, very much akin to, if not building blocks for, the Chinese model's so-called social credit system.
Yes.
Do you see it that way?
Oh, absolutely. I think they'll be merged, in effect, into a social credit score. So the social credit score will consist of basically a personal ESG score, that is environmental, social, and governance score. Effectively, it's already being applied to corporations, and this will be applied to individuals. That's the carbon footprint element. The carbon allowance will be part of that. And then, of course, the health passport will be part of it as well, the vaccine mandate compliance component and other elements. The governance element will be part of that. That is, how well do you cooperate with the state, and how well do you abide by these woke dictates environmentally and social justice-wise? All of that will be part of the social credit score that's being rolled out through these institutions.
Yeah. And I guess there's no doubt in your mind that if we go into business with these various vehicles, whether it's called a vaccine passport or footprint tracker or digital health ID, we are essentially putting ourselves on a fast track to losing our freedoms, are we not?
We'll be in a totalitarian regime like no other in the past, because it will be unmatched for its technological capabilities of tracking, tracing, and, you know, basically controlling the population in ways that are hitherto unprecedented. They're unprecedented.
And again, this is not an accident, comrade, as the Soviet Marxists used to say. This is the design, right? And the purpose the Chinese have in mind. And one of the pieces, which I know you've given a lot of thought to, is it may start out that the World Health Organization or the World Economic Forum generates these projects, these capabilities. But the data will wind up in the hands of the Chinese Communist Party and be exploited by them, manipulated by them, and used to effect control of others around the world. No?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there'll probably be data sharing, or even data manipulation, data control will not be really held very tightly. That'll be very open to confiscation, to hacking, and possibly sharing directly, because this is the design is to basically make this global, and that simply means that everybody, every state, will have the same powers over you, including the Chinese Communist Party state. So this would not be exclusive to the West, and it wouldn't be something that you could escape by going to any other country. And that's the object. Totalitarians don't like you to get out.
Yeah, no escape indeed. And I guess that's, you know, really to this point that we're looking at this being inexorably advanced by so-called supranationalist, globalist, whatever you would like to call them. And we've got to resist this now.
Yeah, I mean, this is the only hope we have. Yeah, we have to resist this now. And if we succumb to this, we're in deep trouble, deeper trouble than we're in now.
No, and I couldn't agree more. And this is why your warnings are so important, Dr. Michael Rechtenwald. We're going to talk a little bit more about one other application of all this, and that's in the digital currency realm, central banks and the like, with Kevin Freeman a little later in the program. In the meantime, I hope you'll stay tuned for a further conversation about what's going on with investing in China with Bill Walton right after this.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. We are visiting next on subjects that are near and dear to both his heart and mine with one of the former masters of the universe on Wall Street. His name is Bill Walton. He formerly was the president and CEO of a big firm on Wall Street by the name of Allied Capital. He has gone on to do other things, notably in Washington, D.C., on the transition team for President Trump, and also as president of the Council for National Policy, a leading conservative organization of which I'm proud to be a member. He is, among other things, though, at the moment, a host of his own television podcast show. It is the Bill Walton Show, a very important platform, I think, for exposing the subjects that most Americans are not paying nearly enough attention to, and that we must. And one of those was the subject of a program I was pleased to be able to participate in with a longtime friend and colleague, Roger Robinson, that aired last week. And Bill, I wanted to catch up with you about that and some of its important findings. Welcome back to Securing America, sir.
Frank, great talking with you.
So Roger, of course, was one of those who played an outsized role in helping President Reagan, who I have the privilege of serving as well, develop and execute the strategy for taking down the Soviet Union by basically cutting off its cash flow. He has been championing for some time, among others with our Committee on the Present Danger China, of which you are an important member, Bill, the argument that a similar kind of effort needs to be made vis-a-vis communist China, because we are, once again, and frankly, on a vastly larger scale, underwriting our most dangerous enemy through Wall Street's financing via American investors primarily. Bill, give us just an overview of the most important takeaways from Roger's comments on your program, and then we'll dive down a bit on what's the state of play at the moment.
Well, you and Roger were terrific. It was a great show and a very distressing topic. And we've talked about this in the past few weeks or past few months, but the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board, which is a mouthful, has a lot of power. It controls where federal retirees can put their savings dollars, and it has options for mutual funds, and mutual funds, many of them BlackRock mutual funds, our old friend Larry Fink, are offering up portfolios that include many Chinese companies. And we've talked about that in the past. Virtually, whether directly or indirectly, every Chinese company is controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. And they're involved in what they call their three warfare, four warfare strategy, basically, whether it's direct kinetic action or whether it's disinformation or whether it's, you know, what have you. The Chinese companies have been, they've all been weaponized. And so what we've been working on, Rogers and you and I have been working with a group of people, Jerry Boykin, General Jerry Boykin among them, is to get the Federal Thrift Investment Board to stop keeping these companies in their portfolios. And to this point, they have not. And it's still, you know, they voted to continue to do it, but the jury's not out. We have got plenty of options to keep putting pressure on them, and we need to keep doing that to change their portfolio mix.
Amen. Bill, you mentioned Larry Fink. He is, of course, the 800-ton gorilla on Wall Street, I guess one might say, some $10 trillion under management of his firm, BlackRock. He has been a driving force not only behind this idea that we ought to be investing more and more and more of our, investors' resources in communist China, but he's also been championing, ironically, a program that is absolutely at odds with the whole Chinese Communist Party's agenda, namely environment, social justice, and governance. And this week he, to my astonishment, announced that, oh, no, I'm not going to be the environmental police. Tell us what that's about and whether it portends maybe a change on China as well.
Well, Larry Fink has been the poster boy for ESG investing, directing his $10 trillion of Blackstone money to vote in favor of ESG proposals and all the proxies of all the major corporations. BlackRock, State Street, Vanguard, so forth, they control about 30-35% of the equity of publicly traded companies, and so they have a lot of clout. Larry had been very public about this, sent very imperious letters to CEOs of all the public companies saying they've got to toe the line with ESG and with diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. And what we've done, and you've been a big part of it, and a lot of us, is we've begun to single out Larry as the poster boy and applying a little bit of the Saul Alinsky tactics, which is personalizing the issue, making it about a person. And we've made it about Larry. And evidently, Larry doesn't like that because at his meeting last week with his investor shareholders, you know, his annual meeting, he walked it back. He said, well, we're not really doing this. And the only reason we want to do it is because we've got this enormous outcry from all our investors to ask us to get into this type of investing. Well, last time I checked, there's not a big hue and cry. There's not a big demand for this type of investing. And so Larry's trying to put it off on market forces, and he's not really the main actor. It remains to be seen. He remains committed to carbon, I can't remember the exact title for what he's got. There are so many of them, they keep changing. But anyway,
I think it's displacing carbon as a source of fuel.
He wants to shut down fossil fuels. I mean, that's the game. So he's still all in favor of that, but he does not necessarily want to be the face of it because that's been a very hot place for him. So it's a limited victory. It's a tactical victory, but I don't think a strategic one.
Not least because I think it's fair to say he's doing an awful lot of damage to, you know, shareholder value in this campaign and trying to force all these companies to conform to his program. No,
I come from the old school of capitalism. I think it's based on voluntary change among market actors, where people are trying to maximize the, you know, their resources, their talents to get the highest possible return, commensurate with the law and morality. That's capitalism, and it's worked very well, bringing billions of people out of poverty, which is something Larry ought to be for. But now we've muddled this whole thing up with CRT and ESG and DEI, and you name the acronym. It's all these things to be social capitalism, which is really a very murky waters. You can't measure it. Now, if I'm a CEO of a big company and you tell me, well, gee, we really care about social justice, we don't care about your profits. Well, that's great. Let's tie my bonus to social justice and not so much returns. And, you know, you look at a company like Coca-Cola, is my understanding, well, they've been marching this in the social justice parade. Their profits have been plummeting. And it'll be interesting to see how this plays out with the board and investors to see whether they couldn't get back to selling Coca-Cola or water, whatever it is they're selling, and being less involved in Georgia politics.
Shareholder capitalism rather than stakeholder capitalism, I think, is the bottom line. Bill, let me ask you about one other piece of this. There is evidence now that the Biden team is not only going to ease the tariffs that Donald Trump imposed on the Chinese Communist Party and its companies during his presidency, but he's also, I'm told, beginning to walk away from an executive order that he promulgated that essentially built on one that Donald Trump had put into place, essentially saying American investors cannot hold the shares of companies that are in China involved in either national security threats or human rights abuses. All of this coming at a time when, as we've been talking about, Bill, there's some real reason for concern that the Chinese Communist Party is becoming more and more set on going to war with Taiwan, for sure, perhaps with other of our friends and allies and certainly our interests in the Pacific, maybe even with us. And I wonder whether, given everything that you've said, is this a time for the president to be suggesting that more money ought to be plowed into China? Larry Fink's agenda, of course, the Chinese Communist Party's agenda. And if he does do this, are we likely to see just further, well, underwriting of the threat we're facing from China, perhaps even fueling their war machine?
Well, you know, the answer screams at you. The answer is no. China, let's set aside for a moment their strategic aims, which is defeat the United States and be the global hegemon. But let's just put it in practical terms as an investor, my world. China's become uninvestable. I mean, it used to be there was a Chinese Communist Party overseeing basically a capitalist system, and then Xi has come in and cracked down on the capitalist part of it and begun much more directional in terms of what it's doing with Chinese companies. And if you're an investor, you really have to worry about what the Chinese Communist Party could do to the company you're investing in. So, A, they've got extremely ominous strategic agenda. B, economically, it doesn't make any sense. There's been very little money made by American investors in China. So there's that. Then there's the utter pliancy of the or compliance of the Biden administration. You know, there was a moment last month where we had some hope. They had a State Department website which somehow removed language that said we do not support Taiwan independence. Well, the Chinese the Chinese reacted to that very badly.
Very badly. Bill, we have to leave it at that. I'm afraid we are hard out of time. This is a topic to which we will return with you.
They put it back on the website, Frank. Last week it was back on the website.
Back on the website, and we're out of time. I'll talk with you again soon. We'll be right back with more.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Summit of the Americas, taking place in Los Angeles this week, should be a moment to address a shocking reality. As a result of decades of not-so-benign neglect of the region by the U.S. government, one Latin American nation after another has succumbed to the temptation to vote in communists or other Marxists in the name of change. Today, the most important nations in our hemisphere, including increasingly our own, are embracing and promoting the radical left agenda of the modern Communist Internationale, doing business as the Forum of São Paulo, under the influence of China, Russia, and Iran. Two more, Brazil and Colombia, may enlist this year. Instead of focusing on climate change, social justice, and buying oil from Venezuela, Team Biden should be concentrating on preserving and expanding the freedoms the Forum of São Paulo seeks to crush. This is Frank Affney. We're back. We're going to talk about a subject that, frankly, was news to me, but apparently in a very important court ruling, a new challenge to the administrative state, what some have been calling the deep state of late, has emerged from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. A man who has been tracking this and talking with the people who brought the case is one of our regulars, I'm very proud to say. Good friend. Indeed, we are borrowing his studio in the Dallas area, Kevin Freeman. The Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman is, of course, his television program at Blaze TV and on other platforms. He's a best-selling author of Secret Weapon and Game Plan. And among other things, the driving force behind a very exciting new initiative, and we're going to talk a bit about it in a moment, the National Security Investment Consultants Institute, a man of many parts and always a great resource. And I particularly want to commend to you the battle plans that Kevin produces with his team for the war room, the economic war room that he hosts. Kevin Freeman, it's good to have you with us, sir. Welcome back to Securing America. And thank you for welcoming us to the Economic War Room. So, Kevin, there's this case called Jarchese versus SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission. Honestly, I never heard anything about it until you brought it to my attention. Tell us, well, what the nature of the case is and the importance, as you see it, of the ruling that's been handed down by this Circuit Court of Appeals.
Sure. Well, the case is a simple one. The SEC came in and they determined that they didn't like what an investment advisor was doing. He had a radio program that was nationally syndicated. And they said he violated some of their administrative rulings and decisions. And so as a result, they investigated him. They said he violated the legislative aspect of it. And then they had an administrative court and they ruled that he was guilty. And some lawyers picked up the case, ran with it all the way to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and they found, wait, lo and behold, the administrative state, the SEC, was acting as the executive, the legislative, and the judicial branches all in one, and that's contrary to what the Constitution intended, and the Fifth Circuit agreed with them. It's a massive ruling with deep implications.
And I think it's fair to say, Kevin, that it's not entirely clear they're actually allowed to be any one of those things, let alone all three of them. They're an agency of the government, the executive branch, to be sure. But to be exercising, you know, powers greatly beyond their, you know, charter is problematic, especially, as you say, in the legislative and judicial arenas. So what are the implications of this, both, of course, for the SEC? I guess Jarchese is a happy camper. But is this going to be appealed, do you anticipate? And that would mean the Supreme Court. And if it's upheld in the Supreme Court, what would you say the likely repercussions would be for the not just the, again, SEC, but the government writ large?
Well, if we went back in history, and I just celebrated with my father his 87th birthday. He was born in 1935. If you go back to prior to 1935, I can tell you how the Supreme Court would rule. They would rule that Congress can't just create an agency and then delegate to that agency all sorts of powers to determine how they were going to legislate, rule. It was called the non-delegation doctrine, so that you just couldn't give that power away. But Franklin Delano Roosevelt created all these agencies in the New Deal, and the Supreme Court was shooting them down. So he threatened to pack the court, much as we're seeing today. And the net result is the court backed off, and all of a sudden they just ignored that non-delegation. Well, this Fifth Circuit ruling brings that back, and it brings back to the idea that Congress can create agencies, and they can tell the agency specifically what they're to do, but they can't vest that agency in the executive branch with legislative powers to create their own rulings for some broad concept, because that takes it too far from the people. And I think that Fifth Circuit decision will be upheld by the Supreme Court, maybe 6-3, maybe 5-4. But this particular court is one that seems particularly open to the arguments that were being made in Jarchese. And so this has huge implications, because it means that all of this deep state, legislative state that's been created in the executive branch may have to pare back and pull back and be more responsive to the people. That means that we ought to be able to elect representatives who will change the laws that will change those rulings. Right now, the EPA or the SEC or the Department of Labor or whatever, they set their own law, and we have no real recourse against it. This ruling could open the door for us to take back our country, at least back to the people and the elected representatives we have.
A word you didn't use, but it's implicit in what you did say, Kevin, but I think it's absolutely of paramount importance, is accountability. Those representative relationships are meant to mean that those elected to represent us are held accountable. You know, I just want to mention in passing quickly, Kevin, that I know you haven't seen it, but I had a chance to see over the weekend at the Western Conservative Summit the premiere of a really powerful new film called Innovation Race. It's been produced by our friend Jenny Beth Martin at Tea Party's Patriots. It is about the Patent and Trademark Office and the kind of power that it used to exercise and the kind of power that it gave inventors in our country, innovators in our country. But it has been taken apart, that constitutionally mandated a patent and trademark system, by the way. And now it's a shadow of its former self, a shell, if you will. And as this documentary makes very clear, the Chinese have figured out that as a result of taking down our patent and trademark system, an opening has been created for them to emulate the original and become much more of a center for innovation, and to eat our lunch, in other words, in that space. It's a fascinating topic to which I hope we can return with you at some point soon, Kevin, after you've had a chance to review the film. It's one of those things that I think we've got to get sorted on rather quickly, get our trademark and patent office back on its footing and encouraging innovation instead of impeding it. We're going to talk more with Kevin Freeman on the other side of a short break about, among other things, the Digital Texan, subject of his newest Economic War Room program, right after this. We're back. And we are joined once again by Kevin Freeman, a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy, a regular here at Securing America, I'm pleased to say, and of course, the host of his own television program, Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. We're very pleased to be using his studio for the moment as we're on the road in the Dallas area. Kevin, thanks again for that hospitality. And you actually had some experience with how it is that we wound up having our patent and trademark system taken down to the benefit of the Chinese Communist Party. Share those insights with us, if you would.
Yeah, well, I watched it happen real time when I was in Congress briefing people like Congressman Frank Wolf. He pointed out to me, he said, you want to talk real economic warfare? Look at all those lobbyists. And he would point out to them, point me in the hall, he'd point them out to me. And they were Chinese funded and they were there with one purpose. And that was to change our patent law from first to invent to first to file. And what's so important about that was you could invent something if the Chinese hacked your computer or picked up word of it and had lawyers ready to file a patent, they could get the patent right out from under you unless you could prove that they stole it. It used to be that whoever invented something, if you could prove that you were the inventor of it, you would get the patent. Now it's whoever files. And that change is devastating to inventors who don't have a big machine behind them to file patents. So that means the individual is at the mercy of the large corporation. And maybe the large corporation is at the mercy of hacking by the Chinese government and filing that way. It really is a bad system, and we do need to relook it.
Yeah. Well, and I think that one of the changes that the Chinese have made to make their patent system more attractive, I think, is using that first to invent model rather than the first to file. We'll be delving into that further with you in the near future, Kevin. In the meantime, I wanted to talk about another initiative that you've been pursuing, I think, quite brilliantly. And I'm not speaking here about the National Security Investment Consultant Institute, though I'm always happy to do that. But talk a little bit about this idea of offering American investors and people trying to hedge their bets in a very volatile currency environment, among other things, against, in particular, what these so-called central bank digital currencies portend. Kevin, you call it the digital Texan. What's that about?
Yeah, well, it all comes down to the definition of money. And most people view this as money. It's a $20 bill. It's a Federal Reserve note. It says for all debts, public and private. And yet, historically, money has been gold and silver. The Bible talks about money being gold and silver. Human history includes chapter and verse about people using gold and silver. And when our Constitution was formed, money was defined as gold and silver. And so they gave the power to coin money to the federal government and denied that power to the individual states. And the idea of coining money means you put the certain amount of gold and silver that you want inside the coin, or you print paper, and those were given powers to the Congress. But it also provided in the Constitution that a state could make gold and silver, pure gold and silver, coins legal tender in that state, measured in ounces of gold, measured in ounces of silver, or grams, or whatever, as long as it's backed by gold. And there was a Supreme Court ruling in 1837 that said that the state could take on deposit amount of gold and silver and issue a receipt that was essentially representative of that if they were 100% backing it. Now, our paper dollars used to be backed by gold. And in 1971, Richard Nixon closed the gold window. When he did, you could exchange 35 US dollars and get 1 ounce of gold. That was the exchange rate. Today, it's $1,850, something like that. And the power, the value of the paper money is lost, in this case, two-thirds of its value in the past 40 years and 98% of its value since the Federal Reserve was created. Gold has kept its purchasing power. And so we've created in Texas, Texas Bullion Depository, so you can deposit gold. And we're working on the legislation that would allow you to then deposit your money in gold and then use a debit card and go to a grocery store or a restaurant or a hardware store and tap that debit card and pay for your purchases with gold. And the other side would receive either Federal Reserve notes, paper money, or gold. It's an alternative way to pay, but it is also a national security opportunity for us to go back to gold and silver.
Yeah. And one of the other benefits of this arrangement, as I understand it, is tax considerations. Talk about quickly about that, if you would.
Yeah. If you invest in gold coins right now, you're buying what the IRS deems a collectible. And if the value of that gold coin goes up relative to the paper dollar, you'll owe a tax on it, a capital gain for that. And so every time you spend that gold, you're having to pay tax. But if that gold is held in Texas in the bullion depository as tender, legal tender, according to the Constitution, that should not be subject to capital gain or loss tax. So it would be a way to own gold and silver without having to pay tax every time you used it. And that is innovative, revolutionary, but it really goes back to an idea that our founders had and they put hidden in Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution. It might be a way to solve the inflation problem. It might be a way to give us a stable monetary system. It might be a way to give us, as an alternative, not a replacement, but as an alternative, those who wanted a gold standard money could have gold standard money. Those who want the monopoly of the Federal Reserve money, that's fine. Federal Reserve has a monopoly on printing money. They can have the monopoly money, and those who want a gold standard can have the gold standard.
But as we've been talking about on this program, and we'll be doing a lot more of it in the future, I'm sure, if you don't want to have the federal government, the Federal Reserve presumably, and its central bank digital currency being able to control your use of your money and perhaps every other aspect of it, this is going to be particularly appealing. It may also be something that other states will emulate as well. Your program features a brilliant friend of ours, Rod Martin, and I look forward to having him on to talk about all this as well. Kevin Freeman, thank you for your time today, as well as your incredible innovativeness. That's the word I'm looking for, despite what the PTO is up to on so many fronts, and for sharing it with us so generously. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. We'll look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow, same time, same station. And I hope you'll be better prepared as a result of this conversation to protect the country we love and then go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.